You're listening to Chris, the Connecticut Radio Information System. And if you're looking for a new job or career opportunity, stay with us for Positive Futures. Learn from area professionals how to enhance and improve your job search, networking, resume writing, and interview techniques. And discover the extensive programs and services that are available to help you pursue your goals. Your host for Positive Futures is Steve Famigletti, Blind Services Vocational Manager at the NEAT Center in Hartford.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Famigletti with another edition of Positive Futures. And today, I have a familiar guest to the listeners, Mary Silverberg, who was on a previous show. And I wanted to continue our conversation that we were having on the next show. So, Mary, welcome back again.
Thank you, Steve.
To the show. It's wonderful to have you back with us.
Thank you, because it's wonderful to be back here with you.
The last time that you and I got together, we talked about your childhood and your education and how you got into being a speech and language pathologist and kind of what some of those experiences were like. And I wanted to bring you back and have you talk to our listeners about your being employed as a speech and language pathologist. So I was wondering if you could tell us about that, what that's been like, maybe what some of your first jobs were like, and so on.
Well, as a speech and language pathologist, the hardest part was to get the first job. And as somebody said to me, they said, you only need one job. You don't need three offers. You got a job offer. It's a place you want to go. Do it. So I did it. I packed up and moved about 90 miles from where I was at the time. I remember what the superintendent said to me. This was back in the day, again, when life was a little bit simpler. Now you go through HR. Back then, you met the principal, you met the superintendent, and he was the one who hired you. And there were very few she's back then also. Yeah, it was very different. But I remember he said to me, he says, He was aware. I have to say this, you know, when it comes to disclosing whether you've got a disability or not, I was choosing to work in the public schools with children. So there are things like lunch duty and playground duty and things like that that I could never really do. I had to be up front. There's not a choice there.
Right.
There's a liability issue. And I would say that to anybody. If you're in that situation, you have to let them know. Do you have to advertise every day that you're working? That you can't see certain things? No, you don't. You can be subtle about it, but there, you do have to let your bosses know. And he said to me, I'm going to take a chance on you. He says, I think you can do it.
Okay.
That's what he said to me. I thanked him, and I proved him right. And I was in that job for 4 years. And I have very fond memories of that. I learned a lot in that 4 years. And when I finally left, I was ready to move on, and it was a very good thing. I also was very fortunate in that job because I happened to have a principal. I still remember him. I could picture him today. He's no longer alive, unfortunately. But I remember he took me under his wing. He says to me, Mary, there's certain things about getting on in a school system that you need to learn. And he would tell me all about them along the way. He was wonderful. He was a real mentor. That's something else that I think anybody, disability or not, if you're fortunate enough to have someone in the workplace who wants to mentor you, you probably get along well to start with. And I think that is one of the most important things. That man, he didn't teach me about speech and language. They taught me all that theoretical information I needed in school. I had to get out, like any other profession, you have to get out and practice.
Right.
And learn how it really works. But he taught me how the workplace worked. And I never forgot it. And I took his advice because he was absolutely right. And it stood me well throughout the years. And I have been very fortunate because with every job, you know, in the beginning you have to prove yourself. And it's like as you move on further and further into your career, they're not taking as big a chance on you because you've got a track record. And I think for anybody that, again, with or without a disability, that build your own confidence that, oh, yeah, I can do this. You know, it may be a different situation, maybe a different population, whatever, but yeah, I can do it. And then there's that new learning curve, as there is with any new job. Again, how much do you disclose and how early? For me, that was clear. But now, you asked, too, about other employees and colleagues.
Yes.
And I am going to go so far as to even talk about with the kids, because I think it's important. You know, sometimes, this sounds really kooky, but sometimes we figure, well, maybe I can hide it.
Yeah.
We do. And it's survival, because sometimes you have to, because people don't want to give you a chance to do something. So you pretend.
Right.
You get good at it. But there are times where you have, you know, you can admit it or you can acknowledge it, but you don't have to. You don't have to talk about it all the time. And I think for probably the first third of my career, I really tried to downplay it. Again, bosses knew because they needed to, and we finessed things. I didn't get lunch duty or any of those things. Or if I did get them, I was with other people. I was never put in a situation that I couldn't handle that way. And again, this is before ADA and IDEA and all of our legislation. So
it was a very different time, for sure.
Yeah, it was. Well, anyway, no, I'm sorry. The train just went off the track, Steve. That's something else that,
that
tends
happens.
To happen later. Oh, but I was, yeah, when we were talking about, I think about maybe the first third of my career, I said I didn't necessarily want to advertise. I can remember something, though, that just struck me when we talk about what do you tell people, colleagues, what do you tell kids? My colleagues all knew that I didn't see well. They, you know, because there were certain things that I couldn't do. Like if I'm going to go into a classroom to pick up children, I'm not going to stand in the doorway or go, you know, be at one end of a room and, you know,
make an
eye signal or something to somebody at the other end. No, it didn't work that way. So I let the teachers know. And they're like, oh, sure, okay, no big deal.
Right.
You don't make a big deal, they don't need to. If you make a big deal, then they're going to wonder, well, why is there a big deal?
Right.
But if you just are matter of fact about it, when it came to meetings, as we, well, for those of you who are not familiar with planning and placement team meetings, it's a legal meeting, and then under special education with kids in the school system, it's when parents, everyone at school, if kids are in high school, they're included, but it's where decisions are made about the education and programming for a child,
right,
or for a student. And I remember being at a meeting. It was this was years ago. It was a first grade student, and the mom came. And for some reason, don't ask me why, the child had not, his real visual disability had not been completely diagnosed. And I remember being in this meeting, and we're asking, it was the first meeting in this, the first meeting in the process, and we're, you know, gathering information from the mom, and mom was, you know, explaining as much as she could, answering her questions. And then, because we were determining, well, what do we need to do to test? What other information do we need to find out what this child needs? And I remember glancing down because I had to read a document, and as I was reading it, mom turns around and looks at me and says, "That's the way my son reads." And I just looked at her, and she says, "The way you read." Well, I read kind of off to the side.
Right.
I've got my own compensating, you know, and I read closely. And mom said, "That's the way he reads." I said, "What do you mean? Tell me." And she just, you know, mirrored back what she saw me do. And I said, "Oh." Well, then that led us into a whole other area of discussion. It built a trust between mom and me. The light went on that day, to be honest. I got more from that mom than she probably got from me. Just never know when you are going to have a moment like that. And that changed the way I thought about dealing with parents and kids.
And you were already a third of the way
into
your career.
Yes.
So this was after your first job.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And that is one of the reasons I love what I do. Because parents come in and they're They just want their kids to be liked, respected, and learn in school. And when you think about it, what else do we want? You know, there's a lot of things we want.
Right.
What do you
right.
really...
But the basics.
The basics. Are you going to like my kid and treat him well and teach him? That's really what scares parents and concerns them most. And after working with so many parents, you know, many others have noticed that I don't, you know, see well. And some I've, you know, depends on what they want to know and what, you know, where, how the relationship goes. But I, after that, that opened my eyes, literally, and I just had a different attitude about it, and I would share. And when I had kids over the years, whether they're elementary age kids or whether they're high school students, I'll talk to you. As a matter of fact, I met a child fairly recently when I was working, and it was a child with a hearing impairment. And he's at that stage where I recognized it at 10 years old when you're angry. It's like, I don't need this. Why do I have to have this? Why yeah. can't I see or hear like everybody else?
Yes.
And I remember one day he was just being a little bit obnoxious. And I said, I want you to stay after class. I want to talk to you. And he looks at me. I said, okay, what's going on? I said, what's wrong? Come on. You're a good kid. What's going on with you today? What's wrong? And he looks at me and he says, did you ever have anything like that when you were growing up? He says, I don't like my hearing aids. He says, I don't like any of these. He says, did you ever have anything like that when you were growing up? Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's going to open up a door, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? Well, that door flung open, and I told him point blank. I said, yeah, I knew where you're coming from. I knew you were angry about something today. I wasn't sure what, but I knew you were angry. He said, well, the door opened, and delightful kid. He's going to be fine someday, and he's going to take his own path, and he will do just fine in this world. He's got the fire under him. I think that's something else. You got to have a fire under you. What is that? Fire in your belly? Is that what that expression is?
Something like that.
You got to be hungry. You got to want it. It's important.
What was his reaction when you shared?
He wasn't surprised because he saw me reading.
Right.
It was like, oh, yeah. Well, I thought something was, you know. No, he was more concerned, though, for his time in of his stage in life. What was it like for you when you were my age?
Right.
He saw how I was doing now. That wasn't what his question was about.
Yeah.
And I got that, and I said, yeah. I said, I didn't like having white hair when I was your age. It was white when you... Yeah, it was. I didn't like that at all. I didn't like a lot of things. And I told him point blank, and he was like, yeah. There was an understanding there between us.
Right, right. And of course, kids, they're not thinking about... They're in the moment.
Yeah.
They're in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something else about you that I know because you and I know each other for a long time. And I know that you're a singer, but I also know that you do ballroom dancing.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to share with our listeners how you got into ballroom dancing and what has that done for your life?
I, like many people, I always love to dance, but you know, we always call it freestyle. You do whatever.
Yeah, whatever's the craze is.
Get out there and move, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my husband and I, when we go to weddings and events, I mean, we dance. Every couple has some routine that works together. And whether it's right or not, who cares? If it works for you, it's fine. So that's what we used to do. But I always used to look at the ballroom dancers and I thought, oh, that's smooth. I really love that. Now, come on. Is there any woman out there who really, you know, wouldn't love to get dressed up in a gown, wouldn't love to have your hair done, makeup, be the queen, and do a waltz around a ballroom? Come on. Fairy tale time, Cinderella. Here we come.
Right.
That's, you know. So it was about a year after my husband had died. And I said, you know, I don't know where I started to think about dance lessons. Well, I'll tell you one of the ways. I hadn't thought about this in so long. I was doing a cabaret, and we were singing, and I was doing a cabaret. We had to do a little bit of dancing. And I remember it was like 2 minutes before intermission, and the director said, okay, when you you women in the front, I want you to go out into the audience and grab a man from a table and dance with him. It's okay if his wife is there, you know. She'll understand. Oh, yeah, okay. So I did. And I got up and I took the hand of this man who was, you know, front table side. We danced for like, it must have been a minute. It couldn't have been very long. All right. It was the way we ended the first act. It was delightful. He and his wife were delightful. And I remember the director said to me, Mary, it's time for you to get back out in the world. Yeah, because she saw the look on my face. There's something about, number one, a man, but it was out there dancing. Because people are full of joy when they're moving. They really are. It's hard to not smile when you're moving. It really is. And I thought, you know, you're right. So I signed up at the local Fred Astaire by me, and I said, you know what? I'll take my three cheap lessons. And if I don't like it, I never have to go back.
Right, but at least then you would know.
Yes.
You tried it, you liked it, or you tried it and you didn't like it.
That's right. And I walked in the door and I took my three lessons, and that was almost 13 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, there was a real joyful feeling about moving. Yes, but ballroom dancing, as you know, it's highly structured. It's all about the form and then the style, then your interpretation and your personality and playing the part, the attitude of the dance, you know, whether it's a tango or an Argentine tango. We can really get into that one. Or whether it's a glorious waltz or a foxtrot that's kind of jazzy and you just kind of glide around the floor. You know, every dance has its mood. And even without the costumes and the makeup and the rest of it, there's a feeling of joyfulness about moving. It's like ask any kid, you know. Everybody loves to, I won't say everybody, but when you sing and if you just let yourself go and sing or dance, anything that, where you're expressing yourself and nobody's necessarily judging you. You're just out there doing it. It feels good. There's a freedom in it. And when you do that with other people, there's a camaraderie. There's a sense of community with the people you do that with that just make it such a warm, rewarding feeling all around. But even after 13 years of dancing, Steve, I have to tell you, because I know you had to deal with this too. The first thing, which I think is harder for men than it is for women, is you have to lead, but we have to be willing to accept your lead. I can't be the boss on the dance floor, and I still struggle with that, but it's like, all right, I'll give in. But it is important if you're going to move well on the floor. But the other thing is there's self-reliance in your own dance and holding your end up of the bargain. And then there's also the trust in yourself that you know what to do or how to do it, and your trust in your partner that they're going to be there for you and lead you and be with you. You know, they're going to work with you. You're together. There is a mutual trust that has to exist. And I don't know, as somebody who, as I said earlier, I learned to be self-reliant early. Trust yourself. I trust is a very difficult thing for me, and I'm not ashamed to say it, even at this stage in life. I mean, I obviously do trust some people in my life, for sure.
Right.
Big time. But dance reminds me of that lesson all the time, because you really do have to trust another human being. If I'm going to fall backwards, you better be there.
Right.
Or if you're going to pick me up and I'm going to be extended out in the air on top, I better trust that you're going to, you know. And it sounds so obvious. Well, of course you can trust him. He's not going to drop you. He doesn't want to get hurt and he doesn't want you to. But it goes beyond that. It goes into how you feel within yourself.
Very true.
And dancing continually reminds me of that. And the further I go into it, because now we get into some, you know, much more interpretive and much, much more difficult, challenging things. And it's like, I have to work on that trust and self-reliance all the time. I can't forget about it. It's what allows me to make progress. And when I get in my own way, then I don't make the progress I want to make. Did you find that when you were dancing? when you're dancing, Steve?
I think so, particularly the first year. Because I was really thinking about myself and did I really want to do this? But I actually have another question for you about dancing in terms of your visual impairment. When you're dancing, does it almost seem like that part of you doesn't exist in a way because it's such a freeing thing?
No, I have to think about it, and I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example. Spot turns. Because of the nystagmus and my vision, and there, I mean, like it or not, and I don't like it, there is a balance issue here.
Yes.
So, yeah, my instructor and anybody who does choreography for me, I mean, I got a two-turn limit here. There's certain things I can do and certain things that are certain things I can excel at, and it really works well. And there are a few things that I am never going to be proficient at. Life is too short to get hung up on those things.
Right.
So I know if I've got a spot turn to do, I have to approximate. It's not going to work. You talk about going in the line of dance. It's not really free form. We're all over the floor.
True.
It looks like it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just watching and enjoying it and taking it in. But when you're dancing, you're always... we should be aware of where we are on the floor. What direction are you going in? Because where your head's going is where your body's going.
Yes.
And sometimes my head used to be down, or it'd be to the left, or it would be somewhere else where it wasn't supposed to be. And then my feet wouldn't go in the right place. So this was, yeah. And I've had some outstanding instruction all these years from several people, and it's always the same thing. Mary, follow the floorboards. Well, if I can't see the grain in the floor, what else am I following? I have to use landmarks. I have to use something to know what direction I'm going in so that the body can be lined up to go there. Otherwise, I run into trouble. No,
right.
I can't forget it.
Do you feel that you have really taught people some important lessons as their students, as you've met dance teachers and, you know, you walk into a dance studio and the teachers, you know, are meeting you for the first time and you're somebody that has a disability and maybe they don't have any experience with that. Do you feel like they've learned from you as well as you've learned from them?
I know they have learned some things from me as well. Yeah. I know my teacher right now, he brought me a video of a man who was blind dancing, partner dancing. And he said, I didn't do it to intimidate you. He said, I did it because I wanted to share it with you. He says, because this man is beautiful to watch. And he was. Guy's totally blind now. But he started out seeing. And I do think there's a difference there. But again, are you going to use it as an excuse or are you going to use it to show a contrast and learn from?
So you haven't had any instructors say, oh, you know, I don't know if I can work with you.
No, I haven't. Because one of them did a wheelchair, had a man in a wheelchair and his wife, they did a wedding dance. They did it at a competition one year and I don't think there was a dry eye in the house.
Wow.
It was just beautiful. They've had deaf students. One of my teachers I know had a deaf student. There's considerations that are different with everybody. And yeah, they're not afraid of it. They take it on. They've had some experience. And they're creative. I think that's one of the things that I like. I'll say to them, that I'm going to practice that from here until eternity, and that ain't going to come. So let's go to a plan B. Can you help me come up with something else? And they do. They think about it. Sometimes we try different things. Sometimes maybe two of them won't work, but the third one does work. And that's what we do. If we try a move that I can't quite do, then we'll just modify it down a notch or change it in some way so that it does work. I think one of the things I had the most fun with was in the beginning was when I was writing, we experimented with different types of lifts. You know, I had watch people do all these crazy things where the guy picks up the woman and he tosses her over his shoulder to one side and then, you know, back to one side and then back to the other side and swings her around. I was like, whoa, I didn't get to do that stuff when I was little because it's like, oh, the little blind kid is here and she's going to get hurt. Got to be careful.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, Mary, don't do that because you might fall. You might get hurt. Don't. Well, you know, it's that I know this from child development. You know, the first 3 years of life, that good old birth to three, use it or lose it. That's where you have to make your mark on movement and body position and space. Here we go with that one again. And just having a sense of where you are in relation to the ground and the rest of your environment. And I think kids with disabilities too often get cheated out of that one because it's like nobody wants you to get hurt. I think we're a lot better than we used to be, but you know, all those good intentions, we don't want you to get hurt and we don't want you to fall. Well, let me fall a little bit. Let me get hurt a little bit. How else am I going to learn? So in dance, yeah, I got to try some of that in a safe situation where I knew I wasn't going to get hurt. I always tease and say, I know if people get hurt, it's bad for business, but it's also like, you know that they know what they're doing and they're going to tell you what your part is, what you have to do in this move. And then you do it and it's like, it's freeing. It is. It's fun. I don't know how else to put it. It's worth some of the angst that I have sometimes because I just love the freedom of it. Yeah, the movement, which I think you really enjoy too.
Yeah, yeah. It is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
You know what? Whatever it is, whether it's your life's work or a hobby, a serious hobby, or something that you want to try, but you're like, I don't know. You know what? Yeah, might as well go for it. We have one life. We're only here for so long, each of us. So if you get embarrassed, okay. You know, like you'll recover. I've been embarrassed more times than I like to think, but it's like, you know what? Live. Life is to be lived, not for you to watch.
It's very true. That's very true.
Get out there and do it. Live life. And you're going to die someday no matter what you did, whether you took the risk or you didn't.
You're right. We're all headed for the same.
Yeah. So you might as well take the risk and just go for it. If whatever you want to do, whether it's volunteering or pay, try it. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it again. But you might like it and you might stay with it.
I once had a college professor talking to us one day and she said, if you try something and you fail, what's the worst that happens? You tried it, you figured out that it didn't work and you pick something else. She said, you know, a lot of people are so afraid to have young people fail and you pick up and you go on.
Unfortunately, we do give that message to kids in school, though. You have to perform. You have to pass this high-stakes test. You have to do well for yourself, for your school, for this district. You have to perform on the test. I hate to say that, but it's true. And we don't allow kids. They used to tell us in grad school, this is the place where you can learn and you can fail. Was it safe to fail? No, not really. The pressure's on and you better perform. I'm not that naive that I'm going to say, that that doesn't exist because it does. But along with that, you still have to have a certain amount of attitude that says, all right, I'm going to try it anyway. I'm still going to be alive when it's over.
Right.
And I might even come out better for it.
Well, thank you so much, Mary. This has been wonderful having you again.
I am so glad you asked me to come on your show because I do enjoy doing this. I enjoy talking with you. And I hope, I figure whoever listens to this show, I know I'm not living in a vacuum. I know that whatever happens to me, I'm sure many, many elements of what I've talked about in the shows, other people have experienced as well. None of us are that unique. We like to think we are, but we're really not.
True.
So, thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mary.
Positive Futures is produced at the Chris Radio Studios in Windsor in cooperation with the Connecticut Department of Rehabilitation Services, Board of Education and Services for the Blind.